Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On Podcast, where we are focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey everybody, welcome back to Drive On. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and today my guest is Michael Nelson. Michael is a Vietnam veteran who, in addition to being a physician, is also a fiction writer, and he's here today to discuss the advocacy work that he does, advocating for people to tell their stories and document their lives. So welcome to the show, Michael. I'm really glad to have you here.
I'm anxious to see how this goes. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe for the listeners who are out there who maybe aren't familiar with you and in your background, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, my name is Michael Nelson. I'm retired about 3 years ago after 4 decades in the healthcare industry. I was a practicing physician, and I was not expecting to retire. So when I did, after a bit of a health issue, I found myself with nothing else to do. So I decided that I would try to write some interesting things about my life, and I started documenting it, and it turned out to be 3 different novels. So I'm a writer by accident.
I totally can relate with that too. The book that I wrote a few years ago, I started just writing down things just more for historical documentation purposes, so I don't forget things as I get older, and it wound up being a book. And I always say, if my high school English teachers ever found out that I had written a book, they'd probably have a heart attack with how bad of a English student I was.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a thing. Thank goodness in writing that they have these people that are called editors who are vicious and cruel and mean-spirited individuals. But they make you get it right. And I used to hate my English teacher for doing exactly the same thing. No,
you have nightmares with the red pen that comes out, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Like, so, I can remember getting things written in the margin of stuff I turned in. Just really?
Like, did you even try? Like, that's the kind of stuff I would get. You know, it was like, come on, put a little bit of effort in here. But you know, you're right though. The editors, that's their job. And you know, if they don't make it as an editor, I suppose there's always a career as an English teacher, or vice versa, I suppose, where they can go and teach people the way to do it, and maybe work themselves out of a job,
yeah, or something, or just hone their craft in a different way.
A tree branch hit a power line in Ohio in 2003, and it shut down 21 power plants, and around 100 people died. We have a power grid that was designed in the 1800s. Even the White House sees it. They're saying 2/3 of the grid are at least 25 years old, so they've recently announced billions of dollars to update it. And how long do you think it'll take to actually do? That's why having your own solar power is more important than ever. With the Patriot Power Generator, you'll get a solar generator that doesn't install into your house because it's portable. You can take it with you, even use it inside. But it's powerful enough for your phones, medical devices, or even your fridge. And right now you can go to 4patriots.com and use code DRIVEON to get 10% off your first purchase of anything in the store, including the Patriot Power Generator. You'll also get their famous guarantee for an entire year after your order, plus free shipping on orders over $97, and a portion of every sale is donated to charities who support our veterans and their families. So just go to 4patriots.com and use code DRIVEON to get 10% off. Again, that's 4patriots.com. Use code DRIVEON to get yours today. Sure. So tell us a little bit about your background as far as, we talked a little bit in the intro to this episode about you think it's important for people to tell their stories, document their lives. What type of event kind of led you to that, where you feel like people should really document their stories and tell, you know, what has gone on in their lives and let it be known for other people?
Well, this is one of those ones where I go, I'm glad you asked that question. This is actually a good story. My dad was a World War II veteran, but it was something that he never, ever would speak about. We would ask him all the time. We knew that he'd been in the Army Air Force, and we knew that he'd had a job that was not a very nice one, but we didn't know very much else about it. And if we asked him, he had the same pat answer. You have to ask, you probably never were there. And so he would stop right there. He wouldn't tell us anything. And he and I did not get along very well when I was growing up, partially because I was such a good student in English and just about everything else. And so we didn't see eye to eye in a lot of things. But then he mellowed when he got older and started to slip into dementia. And suddenly it got to be easier to talk about those times in the war. And he handed me his diary that he had kept. And it was a diary of every mission he flew as a tail gunner on a B-17 bomber. And back then, and believe me, I've researched this because I wrote part of a book about it, the life expectancy of a tail gunner was 5 missions. He flew 26.
Wow.
And so it was easy to see why he had such a hard time making friends. It was easy to see why he didn't want to get to know anybody or talk to anybody. I swear to God, I don't think he ever knew the names of the neighbors. He just was an antisocial character his whole life. But at the very end, when he showed me that, when I read that diary and the hair on the back of my neck stood up, I mean, it's terrible stuff. It's you know, came belly in, dead stick, no landing gear, lost both waist gunners. We go again tomorrow.
Wow.
The idiot chokes me up talking about it right now. So I, of course, went in the service too. And when I came back, it was a different thing back then. Times were different. And we were not celebrated when we came back. Life was hard. And so once again, I couldn't talk to my father about it. My father couldn't talk to me about it. And after I had his diary in hand, I thought, what a terrible thing if I did this to my own kids. So I started writing about not just my time in the Army, although there is some of my time in the Army, but some of the things that make us quirky and some of the things that make us whole are the stories that we hold close and we don't share. And those kinds of things are so important because as soon as you die, it's like a library burned down.
Yeah.
And all that wisdom, all that lore, and the reason how you gained the wisdom, the reason why you got smart, you know, the bruises and stitches that came with the lesson, that's the story. And if you share that, I mean, back in the old days when, you know, lore and sagged life stories were handed down from family to family, it was how we retained our history. And
that's right.
we don't retain our history anymore. We spend all our time in our phones and everything else. So I started, when I was in practice, I spent a lot of time going to nursing homes. And I was amazed at the stories that some of these people would tell me, and there was nobody there that wanted to listen to it until the funeral.
That's right.
And then, you know, then they're hungry for any story. And if somebody had documented it and put it on a little thumb drive and said, here, he wanted you to have this. She wanted you to have this when it was all over and, you know, and the shouting was over. And so that's the reason for the legacy is that we're losing our family history, we're losing our lore, and the stories that go with it are so important.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's more than just family history too, because it's like you just shared the story of your father and in his service to our country. And that's part of our country's history too. And, while, yes, deeply personal connection there between you and your father, that's somebody who served the country that we all live in and that we all benefited from the service that he did, and so many countless other people did as well. And so kind of hearing those stories and knowing what those people went through, I think is important. They did, right. And a lot of times, especially back then, they weren't willing to go look for help with the damage that they incurred while they were over there. It was just not a thing. You just sucked it up and dealt with it, and you just live your life and do the best that you can with what you have to work with, right?
That's exactly right. And unfortunately, it's something that continues to this day. When I came home, there was no support group or anything like that. Shoot, we weren't even talking about Agent Orange back then. That was, and then Desert Storm and the burn pits. And, the tale goes on and on. But the interesting thing about that is that, yes, it's not family history, it's societal history too. But the hook there is there's a heart connection to it. We love the story, but we also love the part that the person telling the story played in the story. We love that. And so we listen harder. And those stories really shouldn't be lost.
Now, what would you say to somebody if they're sitting here listening to this and they're thinking to themselves, well, I don't really have anything interesting to say. Maybe I wasn't the tail gunner on a plane in World War II. I didn't really do anything interesting with my life. What do I really have to say about myself or my experiences or anything? There's really nothing interesting. Who would care to listen to that? What would you say to somebody like that?
Everybody has, it doesn't have to be a history or, it doesn't have to be some epic, dime store novel or anything like that. What I think and what I have learned in doing these various situations and stuff like that is that the story that people want to tell is their memory. Mm-hmm. They want to tell the memory that they get the story, and there's lots of stories that we tell, how Aunt May peed her pants when she started laughing so hard, or Thanksgiving dinner. Oh, that's a story everybody tells. But it's not a story, it's a memory.
Right.
And there are memories that people have. One of the best ones that I ever did, and I started doing this regularly after I found out what a great thing it is I would go to these assisted living centers, and of course, I would set up to talk to the group and things like that. And I would ask them to take a minute and remember their favorite Christmas memory. And the stories that you would hear, oh my goodness, they're just fantastic. And people sitting right next to him would say, I never knew that about you. I didn't know anything about that. That's just amazing. So what I tell them is, don't try to, baffle me with bullshit. Tell me a memory that really meant something to you. And I just use the trigger as Christmas, but there's lots of them.
Right. And it could be anything. It doesn't have to be Christmas. It could be a birthday. It could be just a childhood memory. It doesn't have to be a specific event or anything.
Birth of my children,
There you go. Yeah.
Those are great stories. And there's a few more than I like to acknowledge, but.
Now, do these stories that you're talking about, do they all need to be documented as far as, writing it in a book and being published and getting it out there for the whole world? Or is it just something, to chat about with other people, like you're talking about in a kind of group setting. Is that kind of sufficient for, as far as telling the story, or do you think that more stories should be documented for future generations in a written format?
The answer is yes, of course. You know, I don't think we give ourselves enough credit for the fact that we have really good stories to tell, even though we don't think that maybe, you know, we made the headlines or our 5 minutes of fame or whatever it is. When I started working on what I call the Legacy Project, one of the things that I did was go into these centers and go to the libraries, public libraries. They're glad to do this sort of thing for you. Get yourself a little thumb drive. They'll put you in a special room. They'll give you a laptop. They'll hook it up for you, and you can record, and you can sit there and you can talk about the time that you got a care package from overseas when you were, you know, sitting in the jungle and the mice had gotten in the box and ate the cookies, you know, that sort of thing. It's a memory, but it's a great memory. And you have a little thumb drive. And let's say that Uncle Harry passes away. Now you got this thing that's all of his memories. And you give that to the family and you say, here, he wanted you to have this. And all those memories. And, you know, how many times have you stood in the reception line at a funeral where you're standing there shaking hands and somebody tells a story about the guy and you go, oh, my God. I never knew that.
Right.
Well, what a great gift to have it on the little thumb drive.
You know,
it's all the legacy.
It is. And, you know, a few years ago, my grandfather, he grew up in Poland and he was there during World War II. And he experienced some stuff. He was captured by the Germans and he was forced to work in some, you know, forced labor kind of thing. And I had never really heard, I heard like secondhand stories. And one day where I was at my parents' house, he was there and he was, for some reason, he just started talking about it. And he, at that point, he was pretty much completely blind. He had no idea, you know, who was really around him or anything like that. He just was talking to us. And so I pulled out my phone and I just started recording. When he started talking about it, and I was able to document that story. And after he passed away, like, that story now continues to live on. Like, I can go back and listen to that. I can share it with my kids. I can, you know, share it with other family members and stuff like that. And we have that piece of history now, which would have been lost with him had that not been documented. So
it means so much. Because
sure.
It's in his own voice.
Right.
It's.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's the nice thing about it is in his own voice. It's his word does not, we're talking about editors earlier. There's no editor that went through and, you know, red pen the pages or anything like that. Hey, you should change this and make it sound a little bit more interesting here. No, it was just the way he talked and he just said it the way things were. And it was just a piece of his history. And it was a memory, right? Really, like you were saying, it was one of his memories and he was able to share that with us. And while I was grateful for the opportunity to be sitting there to hear it in person, I was even more grateful that I had the peace of mind to take out my phone and record it. So
Genius.
That way future generations would be able to hear that story as well. And it's just a, you know, I think we need to do that more often, maybe just, you know, sit down and, you know, say, hey, you know, I'd love to hear your story. Do you mind if I record this just so we have it for the future? And like you said,
exactly.
you may end up at that person's funeral years later, and you may just sit around listening to that person telling a story. And it's just a good way to continue their memory, right?
Yeah. And maybe not so many years later.
Yeah,
and that's
true.
That's part of it. You'd be surprised. I was surprised at my own mother that when I said, you know, hey, Mom, I'd kind of like to just hear you sit and tell me a story, but I'd like to record it.
Mm-hmm.
So I turned it on and I got to tell you, she not only talked for like an hour and a half, but she asked me to come back so we could do it some more. And wow. she told me stories that I never would have imagined. She didn't seem like that kind of girl at all, but it turned out that she was proud of it on some level. So,
sure.
So it's great. They want to tell the story. It's just, I have a thing that I post, and it's part of my website, and it says, when our grandparents wanted to tell us a story, we didn't care, so we didn't listen. Afterwards, we wish we'd written it down.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. My other grandfather, he served in World War II in the Navy. He was in the Pacific. He was at the Battle of Iwo Jima and all this stuff. And, you know, I knew him. He died when I was still young. But man, looking back at it now, I wish I knew more about his time in the Navy and the stuff that he did, places that he was at and what he saw while he was there. It's just one of those things where that memory is lost with him. And, you know, maybe he told the story to somebody somewhere along the line. But you know, that it's not the same memory, you know, it gets distorted. You know, you might hear things differently than what they actually, how they actually took place, I should say. And so it's a little bit different. So yeah, that first person account I think is important. And I think we all, you know, especially, military service members, we all have incredible stories, whether you think that they're incredible or not. You don't have to be a Medal of Honor recipient to have an incredible story. You know, we all have stuff that we can talk about, right?
If you wore the uniform, you've got a story.
That's right.
Some of the stories are harder to tell than some of the other ones. But everybody that wore the green or gray, they got a story.
Yeah, that's right. Now, speaking of spending time in the military and stories to tell, I do want to go back a little bit to your days in the military and kind of do a little bit of what we were just talking about and ask you about your time in the military. I know earlier in this episode, you mentioned, you know, how when you were in, it was different times than it is now. Folks were not treated all that well when they got back home. You know, we get treated a whole lot better now than they did back then. But what was your experience like, you know, as far as all of that goes? You know, when you got home, how were you treated and what was that like?
Well, the first thing that happened was, you know, back then, you're a little too young to remember, but back then we had to travel in our dress greens. I was in the Army, so they were dress greens. But you had to dress in your dress uniform and you had to fly standby. So you could be stuck in an airport for 12, 14, 16 hours because you were flying standby. But I can remember when I came back in through San Francisco, walking through the airport and people throwing things, hollering, you know, spilling soda pop on us, spraying us and calling us pigs and baby killers and all that kind of stuff. We were not particularly welcome. And the first week and a half, when I got back out and mustered out, I spent at the VA hospital working on getting myself back on my feet and squared away. Mm-hmm. And I was there long enough to realize that I didn't want to ever have to go to a VA hospital ever again, as long as I, you know, that didn't work out too well for me. Sure. But they've gotten a whole lot better than they used to. So it was also supposed to be good, easy to get a job back then when you got out because you were a veteran and it was anything but. So my partner, Kate, is an attorney. And she said, now listen, he's going to ask you some of these questions. And you got to recognize the statute of limitations has not expired on some of these things. So you cannot go telling those stories. So Suffice it to say that it was easier to be a little bit on the wrong side of the law than it was to be upstanding, you know,
sure,
when you like to learn to eat. But it didn't take very long, and it didn't take very many judgmental looks from my father for me to get my stuff straightened out and get back on board. And I was lucky enough to be in a state where my tuition was stipended by the state if I was a veteran. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, I had the GI Bill, and I bartered that into an engineering degree first. And then after I got my engineering degree, I went back and got my doctorate and started practicing medicine. Did that for 38 years.
That's pretty incredible. What made you switch from engineering to medicine?
I was building nuclear power plants, and then all of a sudden, Three Mile Island happened. And Three Mile Island was, I actually am one of the first team of five that went in the containment vessel at Three Mile Island.
Wow.
When they opened it up to see what the problem was. So I was there as a representative of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. But Jimmy Carter said, that's enough of that. We're not building any more power plants. And so I was out of work, and I got my severance, and I paid my matriculation fee and went back to junior college to get my prerequisites to be a real doctor.
Sure. So when on your website, you have a line that says that you very much enjoyed this aspect of civilian life, which I believe you're referring to your writing career. I'm assuming that's what you're referring to on that line. Is that correct?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's a lot easier to write about the Army and war than it is to live for it.
No problem. Yeah.
In fact, remember, we get back to those stories. If you wore the uniform, you got stories.
That's right.
So you can sit there and write those stories all day long and laugh right along with your pen. But it sure is. That is a lot easier than tying your boots every morning.
Right. Right. Well, and you know, a lot of times there are funny stories too. That, you know, yes, you have the interesting stories, but the things, you know, the heroics and all that kind of stuff. People might have those types of stories, but you also have the funny stories that, again, they're memories. And you know, I can remember my time in the military, just training to go to Afghanistan. We ended up getting our vehicle stuck in the mud, and ended up taking us all night long to get them all unstuck. And it was like, it was a miserable experience at the time, but looking back at it now, it was pretty comical. Like
pretty hilarious.
How many times we got them stuck and unstuck and then stuck again. And just, it was a nightmare, but looking back at it now, it's pretty funny actually. So,
and somehow it was all part of the training routine.
Right. Right.
They probably knew you were going to get stuck.
Well, you know, the funny thing about it is we got to Afghanistan and it was as dry as it could be. There was no water anywhere. There was no mud to get stuck in. So we had all of that experience of getting our trucks unstuck, and we never had to use, which I'm glad. I'm glad I never had to do that while in a dangerous location, right?
Yeah, it's a lot easier when there's no bullets flying.
Exactly, right. So going back to that line, you know, how you very much enjoy this aspect of civilian life. I wanted to point that out because there are so many veterans who just don't find any enjoyment in civilian life. And so to me, it's encouraging to know that you can find joy in your civilian life. Do you have any advice for people who are maybe trying to find that source of joy in their lives after leaving the military?
I do, actually. I spent a long time being angry with the Army. Not for any particular reason, you know, taken as a whole, my experience wasn't all that bad. If you want comic relief, I can tell you some stories about Sure. But for a long time, because of other issues and that I still deal with today, I was angry. And it turns out that part of what I needed to do was tell that story. And to not necessarily write it out, but to tell the story. I used a laptop to tell the story. But what I found was it was very cathartic, because it wasn't anything that was inside of me that was stewing or anything like that. It was out there. It was on paper. I could read about it and nod my head. Yeah, that's exactly how I felt about it. And I'm not saying, hey, everybody needs to sit down and write their story about why they are having trouble adjusting to civilian life. But I think it doesn't hurt to find some listening ears. Mm-hmm. And I can speak from experience on this, boy, can I ever. You don't want to tell that story to anybody, but you really do. And you know you do. And most of the guys, if they would take the time to do it, they would be better off. That being said, I wouldn't mind living under an underpass either, because it sounds like it would be kind of recreational, at least at first.
Sure. You know, that's interesting that you said that, because some people just don't quite understand that kind of mindset. But when you've lived in a foxhole, or, you're out in the jungle or the desert or the wherever, and you're basically living with no roof over your head, you've sort of gotten used to that. And, yeah, you know,
two sheets of toilet paper. Let's not forget.
That's right. That's right. You get what you get, and you use it. But, it's something that's familiar. You were able to manage when you were in combat, living that way. Why couldn't you manage living that way here? I'm not suggesting that everyone needs to go, find their place to squat under the underpass, but.
And by no means am I advocating, for something like that. But I what I'm saying is I understand.
Yeah.
You take a super simplification, you go back to basics, and now it's all about I can get by, this is good enough, I'm not going to expect anything, and therefore I don't need to have anything. Mm-hmm. And so there's a real back to basics thing about it. I'd like to take a look and see what the statistics are of people that are homeless and how long they stay homeless, or do they rotate in and out? Do they move on? Do they come back? Those are the kinds of things I'd like to know while we're getting their stories.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a good point, getting their stories too, because, I don't think anybody as a kid growing up is thinking to themselves, man, I'd love to be homeless someday. Let's aspire to that at some point, right? But there's something along the way that got them to that point where that's where they were, and they are homeless. And so what is that story? What does that look like? And I gotta imagine there's some stuff to be learned there from those stories. Things that just didn't go right, or maybe you thought things were going great and they weren't going great, and there's just some changes that needed to be made, and you just have to, if you made this one other decision, if you made it one way versus another, maybe you would have, you would have ended up okay, landed back on your feet, but you made the wrong decision, and that's where you ended up, and that can help other people too, right?
Sure can, and that's the point. Yeah. That's the point behind the whole thing.
That's right. Yeah. Well, Michael, we mentioned earlier in the episode that you're also a writer yourself. Tell people a little bit about the types of books that you write and the stuff that you do, and where they can go to find the books that you write.
Hey, okay. Well, the first answer is what kind of books? The answer is I don't know. The first three books, like I said, they actually started out, I was just trying to write stories that I could share with my sons about who I used to be before I was like a, they only knew me as a doctor. They didn't know me as anything else. Mm-hmm. And I was a fully well-rounded individual, robust and happy-go-lucky. And so I started writing about those episodes. Somebody read those episodes and said, this is such a great story. You should just, you know, lengthen it out. Well, I did lengthen it out, and one book became 2 books and 2 books became 3, but they were, you know, essentially about me. And instead what we did was we took them and we made them essentially about an anti-hero who pursued criminal ways and did had a massive adventure. And we take that fellow through the inner cities of Chicago and through the jungles of Vietnam, and we take him back out on the mean streets of the city again and take him all the way to the inevitable outcome. And so those 3 books, then the third one, after the fellow gets straightened out, he becomes a country doctor and he does house calls and he tells the tales of what each house call is like, only the interesting ones though. And so those 3 books, Bless Me Father and For I Have Sinned and The Heretic, are one particular group and they follow one particular person. And those three are written under my pen name, which is Michael Dees. My middle initial is D, and my mother always called me Michael D. So these are Michael D's books.
Okay.
So Michael D's is the author for those, and they're available on Amazon and Barnes and Noble and stuff. And then the last two, I was done writing and I had a tag along daughter who said, you got to keep writing, Dad. And I said, no. And she said, no, you got to write about us. And I said, no. And she said, no, you got to do it and I'll help you. So she did all the research and we wrote a story about she and I that, well, actually she's a magical witch and she's very powerful and she has friends that are elves and fairies and things like that. It's young adult series and there's 2 of them now. And they're really, really fun to write. And she gets a kick out of going to book signings and different things like that with those.
Sure.
And those are Annie Abbott and the Druid Stones and Annie Abbott and the Race to the Red Queen. And they're very popular, apparently.
Do you think your daughter noticed maybe a change in your attitude or your well-being when you were writing? Did you think she noticed that? And maybe that's why she encouraged you to continue to write?
Well, not nearly as crabby when I'm writing. That's, yeah. Not only that, but I'm not bothering them, which is probably another thing that's kind of important.
Well, you know, I know our families, they pick up on these things and they notice these changes. And, you know, sometimes we should just take the advice that our families are giving us. And, you know, they think that might be something that's good for you. And they're trying to help you out with that. So I think in that case, maybe that's what was going on. You know, but for the listeners, your families are, you know, for the most part, they're going to be looking out for your best interest. And if they see you find something that is helping you in a positive way, or changing you in a positive way, it's something that they may encourage you to do more of. And maybe you want to listen to it, right?
That's exactly right. Whatever you turn your hands to, you're actually telling a story.
That's right.
Whether you make woodcrafts, whether you, you know, build furniture or roof houses or whatever it is, you're actually telling a story with your hands.
Yep.
And all of that is valuable.
Absolutely. Yeah. I had another guest on the show years ago, and she did like clay, like pottery and artwork and stuff like that through clay. Yeah, I guess pottery. I guess that's what it is. And it was really her way of telling her story. You know, it wasn't a written documentation of things, but it was just her way of telling her stories. And they were beautiful pieces of artwork. But like you said, it could be it could be any means of creating things like woodwork or, you know, whatever. And it's just, you know, your way of sharing it. And it's a good way to, get that off your chest, just release out into the world. Right.
Right. Whether it's written or whether it's just your expression in one way or another, you're absolutely right, Scott.
In a startling description, the UN food chief warned the world with the words knocking on famine's door. He called what we're facing a perfect storm of a perfect storm. And he's not alone. Barron's published that a food shortage could be coming even in the US. And farmers see it too. John Boyd Jr., a fourth generation farmer, told Fox News that we're going to see empty food shelves in the coming months. That's why getting survival food is more important than ever now. Create your own stockpile of the best-selling Four Patriots survival food kits. It's not ordinary food. We're talking good for 25 years super survival food. It's hand-packed in a family-owned facility in the USA, and it gives jobs to over 200 Americans. They have different delicious breakfast, lunch, and dinner options, and you can make these meals in less than 20 minutes. Just add boiling water, simmer, and serve. And right now, for the next few days, listeners of Drive On will get 10% off their first order at 4patriots.com by using code DRIVEON. Just go to 4patriots.com and use code DRIVEON to start your stockpile today. Yeah, yeah. Well, I like to do a segment at the end of each episode, add a little humor to the episode. We kind of had some good laughs, you know, earlier as well, but you know, I always like to end on a funny note. And I have this segment that I call Is It Service Connected? And it's basically America's Funniest Home Videos for Military Edition, where we watch military doing something, maybe they're doing something stupid or something happens to them, and we watch it and we can have a good laugh at it. It's, you know, no one gets seriously injured with these things. And so we take a look at it and say, you know, would this be service-connected disability somewhere down the line if they were to, you know, go that route? So if you don't mind, I'm going to pull that video up here real quick. And we can it's just a quick little video here. So for the podcast listeners who don't have a video for them, I'll try to describe the scene for you as best as I can. Looks like it's probably somewhere in Iraq or Afghanistan. Got a bunch of soldiers standing around and a big crowd of people, which always made me nervous whenever there was a big crowd of people kind of off on the side. And there's a couple soldiers off on the other side of the screen. Let's play this video and see what happens. And it looks like, that I think happened way too fast here. Let me slow this down and bring this back. Okay. So what happened on the bottom left corner, there's a little kid, looks like he has a rock and he took it and he chucked it towards the soldiers. And, if you watch this guy here, yeah, he gets nailed right where you don't really want to get nailed as a guy. It's a big,
really
rock.
Big rock here.
Yeah. So that was probably not the best place to get hit. I don't know if there's going to be any long-term disability there. Maybe we can find out after the guy has kids. If there's any issues with those kids that don't come out quite right.
The psychological damage alone, we should be.
That's true. That probably was. Pretty damaging psychologically. So yeah, they may have some claim there having that happened. I don't know.
I gotta say, he does, but he better report it right away.
I know, right? Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. Go get it checked out. Go and you know, suck up your pride and show Doc what's going on. All right. Well, Michael, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. I really, really do appreciate you taking the time to come on and sharing some of your story and your background and for everything that you're doing to help other people get their stories out there. I do appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Scott. You made it fun. Okay.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On podcast. If you want to support the show, please check out Scott's book, Surviving Son, on Amazon. All of the sales from that book go directly back into this podcast and work to help veterans in need. You can also follow the Drive On podcast on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, and wherever you listen to podcasts.